She is a new wave icon, an accomplished actress, an author, a speaker, and a reality show star, and of course, a fabulous musician with 13 top 40 singles in the UK, as well as 20 albums in her long career. She's getting ready to start a tour called From Sheep Farming to Anthem to celebrate the 30th anniversary of her album Anthem. Please welcome Toya Wilcox. Hello, Toya.
Hello, Julie. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
I'm really good. Here in England, we are still feeling really good about the royal wedding. The weather's been fantastic. So it's quite a feel-good country at the moment.
Oh, that's good. You watched it, didn't you? It sounded like you really enjoyed it.
I spent 7 hours watching it.
Did you?
I'm not usually a royal watcher, but this was so special.
Did you have a little gathering, or did you watch it by yourself?
No, funnily enough, I didn't have a gathering. It was one of the first days off I've had this year, so I just stayed in bed.
Well, that's the way to do it, stay in bed and have a little breakfast or whatever.
And watch someone else's wedding.
How did it compare to your own?
It was far grander. My own was quite eccentric because my husband, who's Robert Fripp, mm-hmm. the guitarist, he's quite reclusive, and I'm very well known in England. And someone, a member of press, cottoned on that we were getting married in secret. So when we left the church, they were there ready to take a photograph of us, and my husband did a runner. He disappeared, and I didn't see him again until the reception.
So you did your ceremony, and then he vanished?
He vanished. So the royal wedding was the perfect romantic, the prince saves his young girl type of wedding. It just was unbelievable.
Yeah, that's people were pretty into it here. It was like a fairy tale to them.
Well, even people here who aren't pro-royal and who aren't pro-marriage really saw it as something quite special, and everyone entered into the spirit of it, which I think made it even more magical.
Right. What did you think of Beatrice's hat?
You know, I was looking at it this morning, and it didn't bother me at all, because everyone in Westminster Abbey had this beautiful kind of English eccentricity about them. They all had quite strange hats on. And I thought, how wonderful that these new, young, kind of royal-blooded people are slightly eccentric. And I thought it was glorious, and it didn't bother me at all. I don't know Fergie, the mum, at all, but I know her sister, Jane. I've actually worked with Olivia Newton-John and Jane for a hospital in Australia.
Right.
And you know, they are an eccentric family. So it didn't surprise me at all. And if anything, hats off to Beatrice, excuse the pun, yeah. Because she dared to show that to the world. And I don't think she deserves the ridicule. I actually think she deserves a big pat on the back for being individualistic.
That's a good point. Did it remind you of any of the hats you've worn over the years?
Well, I didn't wear hats. I just have big hair.
Well, I've seen some pictures of you where you've had, I think, newer pictures where you've got like a big headdress.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. In recent years, yeah, I have kind of quite big headdresses on. But 30 years ago, I just had bright pink hair, and it was massive. It was bigger than me, and I'm not a very tall person, but my hair would stand up about 2 feet, and so I'm used to all of that kind of expression.
You've always had fabulous hair. Did you color it? Did you cultivate your look already when you were in school still?
Oh, yes. I was your typical rebel in school. I mean, pretty soft by today's standards, but I went to an all-girl religious school. It was Church of England, very, very strict. We weren't allowed to talk to boys if we were in school uniform. So I started dyeing my hair when I was about 14. I had blue hair,
oh, wow.
And then I had yellow and green hair, and then I moved on to pink, which was far more flattering. But I was doing it at a time when people weren't really doing that. It was considered so outrageous that taxis wouldn't pick me up and take me home. Buses wouldn't let me on the bus. People really had a problem with me.
So this is really before the onset of punk rock?
Oh, yes. This was about 1974.
Oh, my goodness.
very early.
So you were definitely ahead of your time, ahead of the curve.
I was ahead of my time, and I was still in my early teens. I was 14, so people just couldn't get a handle on it at all.
What did your family think about it?
My father kind of, being a rebel himself and a survivor of World War II, he was away for 6 years in the Navy, so he's probably seen anything and everything you could possibly see. So he was quite accepting. My mother, who was a dancer who retired to have a family, just couldn't handle me at all. And there was a time when I was sent away to live with a Hindi family.
Oh, wow.
Who took me under their wing and looked after me while my mother and I tried to sort our relationship out.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were fantastic. And they used, the mother of that family would lecture me and say I wasn't to influence her daughters. Well, I mean, the daughters were already influenced. That there's a sense of freedom in England that no tradition can hold on to. And their daughters, who could have had arranged marriages, were just beyond saving. They were out there being worse than me. So it was a very interesting period for me.
Were you already pursuing the music thing? Were you writing songs or playing at that point?
I was writing poetry, most of the poetry that went on to an album called Anthem.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really been a musician. I'm a lyricist primarily, and I can hear melodies. I can sing a melody to someone, and it can be a good, complex melody, but I can't physically play it.
Right.
So back then I was writing poetry and learning what I loved about a song, but I wasn't really a musician.
Who do you consider your musical influences?
Well, back then it was Roxy Music, Alice Cooper, who I just think is the sexiest man on the planet.
Oh my goodness.
I know. David Bowie, huge influence.
Right.
Bowie kept me sane. To be a kind of middle class girl in Birmingham in the early 70s, when really all I was being educated to do was to get married young and have children, was pretty frightening for me. And when Bowie came along and he was so descriptive and so expressive, it just gave me a sense of vocabulary I couldn't find on my own. And it gave me a lot of strength to just break away and move to London.
That's terrific. I know he was a big influence on another singer I'm very fond of, Kate Bush. We'll often mention him as an influence.
Well, Kate comes and visits us here.
That's wonderful. I wish you would guys would do a project together. That would be phenomenal.
If she asked, I've got, I'd fall through the floor. The thing with Kate, when she works in an insular way with her team. She doesn't like to be distracted by any other influences. So.
Right.
And then we get to hear from her when she's finished a project, because she seeks kind of advice on who the best press are to talk to, because she's not a very public person.
That's the impression I get, that she has a reputation, at least here, of being one of those people who doesn't leave the house very much.
Well, that is a true representation, but she comes to see me in shows, and
that's terrific.
She likes my husband a lot, and she's incredibly connected with the arts. She loves film and theater, but she just doesn't like being photographed, so that's
right.
Where the privacy is.
Yeah, I can understand that. I don't like being photographed either. Back to David Bowie, he is another one who is very much ahead of the curve as far as the crazy clothes and the crazy hair. So that, you know, that could have also been a big influence on you.
Oh, hugely.
Exploring,
I mean,
your look.
And the thing with Bowie, he never had a bad day. He never did an outfit where you went, ooh, mistake. Everything he did was a revelation and an epiphany. You just look at it and go, whoa! And you just felt so connected to the future. For me, he never made mistakes in the 1970s.
Right.
It was such a glorious decade for him. And you never had to forgive him anything.
Right, right. And his Ziggy Stardust hair is not dissimilar from a lot of the hair that you had. And it's a similar color, right?
It's similar, except I have better hair.
Well,
it's longer, and it's been around longer, and it's good, healthy hair.
Right, right. Well, in addition to your music, you're an amazingly accomplished actress. Unfortunately, a lot of your stuff doesn't make it here. as far as the television and movies and stuff. I've seen, I saw Quadrophenia.
Yeah.
And I saw you in The Corn is Green with Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, my God.
Which is a fabulous film. Was that a television project?
Yeah, it was made by Lorimer Productions in 1978.
Right.
Katharine Hepburn and George Cukor, the director, came over to England with Lorimer because they wanted to make The Corn is Green, which is a Welsh classic play,
right,
in Wales. And they were looking for two new young stars, a boy and a girl. And I auditioned with about 2,000 young girls. And Katharine Hepburn took to me immediately. When I did the first audition, I wore a wig because I was working at England's National Theatre. And even though I was a punk rocker with bright red hair, having just been in a seminal punk movie with Derek Jarman called Jubilee, I wore a wig that made me look like a normal, everyday person. So when I went to meet Katharine Hepburn the first time, I wore this wig. And she just took to me, and I was called back the next day, and I went back the next day without the wig. And when George Cukor opened the door to me, he asked me if I'd like to take my hat off. And I said, it's not my hat, it's my hair. And he had this kind of look of, oh, what have I done? And he took me in to the lounge where Katharine Hepburn was on the sofa, and he said, can you believe this girl's hair, Katharine? And Katharine got up and she ran her fingers through my hair, and she just said, I wish I could have done that when I was your age. And we had these great conversations about when she started out in theater in Washington, D.C., she had terrible reviews about her manliness and her angular features and her discordant voice. And those reviews came at a time when her mother used to always come and see her in productions, and the mother wanted her to leave the business. And it really badly affected Katharine Hepburn. So for her to meet someone like me who was always just challenging establishment, we got on like a house on fire.
That's terrific.
I adored her.
That's terrific. Did you and Katharine Hepburn become buddies?
I wouldn't say we became buddies. We were working together every single day for about 6 weeks. And in that time, we did eat together. We talked together a lot. She'd always invite me into her dressing room every morning when my makeup had been done and hers was being done. And we'd just sit down and talk about what life was like for me as a young girl being a singer and what it was like for her as a young girl.
Right.
I wouldn't say that we were buddies because she was exactly like Kate Bush, phenomenally private.
Mm-hmm.
So once the filming had finished, I never met her again. But she very kindly wrote about me rather brilliantly in two of her biographies, her autobiographies.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I kind of made an impression there, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that a lot of people didn't take your acting seriously back then?
No, it's the opposite, because I was nominated for awards, and I was nominated for Best Newcomer Awards.
So they didn't take the music seriously.
They didn't take the music seriously. And then suddenly, because it was 1978 when I was working with Katharine Hepburn, and at that point I was the bright new young acting star being nominated for everything.
Right.
Three, four years later, I suddenly was commanding audiences. Well, my largest audience was 12 million.
For a play?
It was a live BBC broadcast concert on Christmas Eve, 1981.
Oh, wonderful.
So even though people always found me quite strange, and the only comparison really is Lady Gaga, is that, you know, I commanded such huge audiences, it made people kind of take note, I suppose.
And it wasn't similar to a lot of the music that was around back then. It was very, you know, except for the punk rock, which, you know, back then was never really accepted. Probably more so in England than here, but it was probably still quite fringe over there, certainly that early on. So, you know, I think a lot of people didn't quite get what you were doing with the wonderful, fabulous outfits and the music that wasn't necessarily always a sing-along or a dance kind of thing. It was much more artistic than that.
They did get it because I was nominated as the best singer in 1982.
Oh, that's terrific.
Oh, yeah. I won a lot of awards. I was huge.
I know that you were huge. I don't really have a real clear view of that because I grew up in the States.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's terrific. Speaking of Lady Gaga, what do you think about her?
I think she's amazing. Firstly, she's a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. She has a great voice. And it's so wonderful to see someone who is so fully fledged as a singer-songwriter musician. I'm a huge fan of people like Tori Amos and obviously Kate Bush and PJ Harvey and Goldfrapp. But what's so, for me, so exceptional about Lady Gaga is you've got someone on a par with Elton John who is just completely beautifully formed in her talent.
And right.
I really enjoy everything she does.
That's terrific. What do you think of the outfits?
Well, do you know, this is a really interesting one because as a woman of 53, I can see that she doesn't need the outfits.
No, absolutely
not. The talent
not.
Is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was her age, I didn't believe in myself enough to not have pink hair and not dress outrageously. So as someone who's twice her age, looking at this remarkable talent, I actually slightly prefer it when she dresses down a bit.
Right.
But that's purely because I see this exceptional human being. But I think her outfits are great. When they are those beautiful kind of science fiction molded plastics, they're my favorite. I love them.
Right. Not so much the meat.
No, I didn't get the meat one at all, to be honest. But I don't think anyone did in England.
Yeah, well, she is certainly huge over here. Is she that as huge in England right now?
Massive. Everyone talks about Lady Gaga every day.
Yeah, she's a spectacle, that's for sure. What else do you listen? Well, you said you like Goldfrapp.
Love Goldfrapp.
Goldfrapp is the very.
I've loved them since is it Felt Mountain or Velvet Mountain?
Mm-hmm.
The voice, it's just so extraordinary, and again, beautiful writing technique. So big, big fan. I mainly listen to people, women, like Goldfrapp, like
right.
Kate Bush.
Right, I'm the same way.
Is Tori Amos a big name in America?
Yes, she is. She's quite a big name. She has a huge obsessive following.
I'm pleased, because I just think she's great. The critics here give her a really spiteful time, but that gives me strength because they give me a spiteful time too.
Do you think part of that is because she's American and an expatriate?
That's just racist. No one would stand up for that. I don't know what it is. She just presses men's buttons over here, probably because she just speaks out politically about women and has very strong opinions about politics, which I think always riles men over here.
Right.
Well, a woman with a mind, you know, what do you do with that?
Right.
They prefer their women to be servile and horizontal.
This is true. Yeah, she gets kind of a bad rap from the men around here, too.
Does she? Oh, my God, I'm so surprised.
Yeah, it's more a following of women and gay men, I think, are the ones who love Tori here.
Well, they're the best.
Yeah. Do you have a similar experience there?
Yeah, I'm just writing a lyric now for a guy called Paul Masters who works with Boy George. So I am totally in tune with my gay following.
That's great. Back to the acting thing. I know I read that you were a big Doctor Who fan.
Huge Doctor Who fan. And at one point, Katie Lang and myself were up to play the first female Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
And that was in the late 1980s, early 1990s.
I can't picture Katie Lang.
I know, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think she could do it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't happen, and I remain eternally optimistic that one day I might get to be in this brilliant series. It's huge over here, and it always has been huge.
Right,
when I was a child, I used to hide behind the sofa and watch it in extreme feelings of terror running through me. I was so scared of it. But now I just think it's really magnificent.
Yeah, it would be wonderful if they could get you a little guest starring shot.
Oh,
on
I don't
there.
Want a little guest starring. I want the big job. I want to be the doctor.
that would be fabulous. It definitely is time, more than pastime, for a woman to be Doctor Who. I was very happy to see you. I am a Secret Diary of a Call Girl fan, and it was so lovely to see you appear on that show as her mom. Are there any more Call Girl appearances coming up, do you think?
I did the first series, and then the second series, the family are in the first episode, and then it went very young. Mm-hmm. It's as if the exec said they only want people under 30 in the program, so the family don't appear again. In the second series, it's quite a funny scene. It's a nightmare scene, but they finish filming here now as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the current series has pretty much just started here, and they keep giving her, like, they gave her a teenage girl to hang around. It's like they've decided she's too old now.
Yeah, that's when the family started to disappear. I was in on the readings for that series. You all sit round a table, the whole cast, and you read through each episode, and that's where I was there when the young girl was introduced, and you could just see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
It's like, right, okay, anyone over 30, you can leave the room now.
Oh, that's such a shame. You know, it's very much that way here in the U.S. too, and you always hope that other countries would be a little bit more accepting.
Well, the BBC here has had a lot of public argument about the fact that they do tend to get rid of women over 40. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of criticism, and I think they are trying to make a huge effort to reinstate women from each decade. They're more interesting. I mean, I don't watch anything if there's no one of my age group in it. I'm not interested. So I think the BBC is trying to address it.
Right. Well, there is an older character, older female character, I can't remember her name, on Doctor Who has a lot of scenes. You know, she's semi his love interest, I think.
Oh, it's not Sarah Jane.
Not his companion. No. There's Alex something or other.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yes, she's on the show.
She's extraordinary. She's got something, as a person in real life, she can speak about 5 languages and has a diploma.
Oh, my goodness.
In ancient Greece.
Is she a friend?
She is just remarkable.
And you've done a lot of reality television.
Well, yeah, in England, reality television is all that there is to do. I mean, it's ludicrous over here. I mean, every other program is a reality program.
It's the same here, unfortunately. You know, I really think it's killing scripted television. You did, what is it, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here?
Yeah, I did that in 2003.
That's a while ago. Where did they stick you?
We were in the we were in Brisbane, on the Gold Coast, in a rainforest.
How did you manage that? Did you enjoy it?
I can't say I enjoyed it, but it was one hell of a life experience. You were genuinely locked in the jungle. Do you have an American version of this?
We did. I don't think we do anymore, but we did for a while.
Well, they genuinely lock you up in a jungle and starve you, so it's quite a phenomenal experience.
You know, it's a Celebrity Survivor.
It's a Celebrity Survivor. Yeah. It has 17 million viewers in England.
Oh, my goodness.
In Great Britain, so it's a big, big show. And it was absolutely fine. I have no regrets about doing it, and I don't feel it was life-changing, but it was exceptional.
Do you consider yourself, are you an outdoor girl?
Yes. I am an outdoor girl, definitely. Bearing in mind, I've lived for 25 years with an indoor husband, so
somebody has to go out.
he's very reluctant to go out, and if it's raining, he won't even get out of bed. But I love being outdoors.
The rain, you hide in bed every time it rains in Britain. You're not going to be out much.
That's true.
You also did something, going back to, you mentioned Olivia Newton-John before, another woman I've been listening to for my entire life. You did a walk to Beijing with her.
Yes. That was 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and we were flown out to Beijing. There was Olivia Newton-John the sister of Kylie Minogue, Dani Minogue.
Dani Minogue, mm-hmm.
And Jane Ferguson, who's Princess Fergie's sister,
mm-hmm.
was the main organizer. And we were walking to raise money to build a cancer hospital in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was phenomenal. It was a great experience to go into kind of the Mongolian desert where the wall starts and just be walking deserts day after day, day after day. And the wall at that point is only mud and straw. It's not a massive brick wall that you can see from outer space.
Right.
It was a fabulous experience.
So it was basically a walk along the wall?
The idea was a walk along the wall, but the wall was so big and we only had 2 weeks to do it in that we flew. We had five flights along the wall right into deep China,
wow.
right up to old Tibet. And as you probably know, Olivia Newton-John is Buddhist, so mm-hmm. we asked permission to be able to pray in some of the old Buddhist sites. And the Chinese were incredibly friendly and hospitable, and they allowed us to pray, you know, which they could have stopped us. They
right.
they don't allow all that to go on. And they took us and showed us secret Buddhist caves and things like that. They were fabulous to us.
That's sounds like such an exciting experience. You know, you never stop, do you?
I don't stop because life is short.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get older, time goes quicker. It speeds up.
Oh, absolutely. I know
I
that.
I have no interest in stopping. I don't feel I've arrived anywhere. I have a permanent feeling of, well, that was the journey. I don't think I've arrived. What shall I do next? It's quite an odd feeling. So that spurs me on.
Do you ever go on holiday?
No, I don't, but I will next week. It's my 25th wedding anniversary. It's my husband's birthday and my
birthday.
And
your birthday.
And for the last 6 months, we've been nursing my mother, who has cancer, and we're having a week off, a week of respite. So I have a home in France, and we're going there, and the telephone will be turned off.
That's wonderful. A little second honeymoon action right there.
Oh, we need it. It's been a long, hard slog, so I'm looking forward to it.
In 25 years, people are still saying it'll never last, right?
everyone's still cynical.
That's so funny. I mean, it is a very unusual pairing, but why would you say, you know, that it's not going to last? I mean, it's cruel, and obviously it has stood the test of time.
People, I think, are cruel when they're not made to face their own words. So, for me, as you say, the test of time is there, and if people want to be cynical, then that says more about them than it does about my relationship. So I tend to just ignore those kind of people anyway, that they'll move on to someone else to be spiteful to. So I just don't give them much time.
Right. And I find it interesting that you are very, very big in England, and Robert is very big here.
Yeah.
Have you ever played in the U.S. at all?
No, I'm playing in September.
Is that the House of Blues gig?
Possibly. Yes, there's that as well. My band, The Humans, are about to sign a contract with a record company based in New York.
Oh, wonderful.
And I'm not allowed to say who it is yet.
Right.
And we will be touring in September.
Through the U.S.?
Yeah, East and West Coast.
That's wonderful. Maybe we can actually have you come in while you're here.
It would be a pleasure.
That would be awesome. It's a long overdue for you to play here.
Well, it's about 30 years overdue.
Yeah, yeah. And you do have, you know, you don't have a commercial name recognition, but you do have a huge following here.
Well, even if I only had you, it's worth coming over.
No, I mean, you know, I had mentioned you on Twitter. And people, I guess, were doing searches on your name and found me and started listening to my show. So there are people here who are very committed and who have been listening as nearly as long as I have.
Well, that's fantastic, because hopefully around September, October, I'll come over and do the Toya concert, which is the first three albums.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful.
And then we'll do the Humans concert as well, which the Humans is myself, Bill Rieflin, who has been drumming in REM for the last 7 years, but he's a multi-instrumentalist, so in the Humans he plays bass and keyboards. So basically, the Humans are three people. There's Chris Wong on bass, Bill on everything, and me on vocals. And we're going to come and tour a new album, which is called Sugar Rush.
Right. And Robert is on the new album as well, right?
Robert is on the new album, but Robert doesn't tour anymore.
Now, he doesn't tour. He did play not too long ago downtown in New York, I think just by himself.
Yes, doing soundscapes, and that
right,
was his
right.
last ever live appearance.
Really? You don't think he's ever going to do it again?
I've heard this about every 2 years in the last 25 years.
So he's like the Rolling Stones. He's retired every couple of years.
Well, with the Humans, he liked what we were doing, so he turned up at the studio and joined in. So as long as you don't hem him in and corner him and trap him, he gets involved.
It is to be his idea.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And, you know, with us playing in America, say we go down a storm, he'll be there.
Right. There was a story about, were you in Estonia when you put that band together?
Yes. The president of Estonia phoned up Robert and asked Robert to play at his birthday party.
Oh, wow.
4 years ago, and Robert said no. It's a stock answer from Robert. And so I phoned up the embassy and I said, I'll put a band together and write the music, especially for the president. And they said yes. And they flew myself, Bill Rieflin, Chris Wong out to Estonia a week before the actual performances. And we wrote 45 minutes of material. Ended up touring Estonia to sell out venues.
Wow.
And performed a private performance for the president. And he loved it so much that we then flew straight to Seattle and recorded it all in Seattle and released the album dedicated to Estonia.
Now, how did you end up recording that in Seattle?
Because Bill lives in Seattle.
Oh, I see. Okay. You still have quite a following overseas, I know. Do the Angels and Demons still hang around outside your shows?
The Angels and Demons have turned up at my last four shows because I am performing those critical first three albums. So I was playing a venue in Birmingham, which is in the middle of England.
And your home, right?
It's my hometown. Mm-hmm. And I looked out over the audience and I recognized virtually 80% of the audience
The
Angels and Demons.
That's fantastic. Are there some new young ones as well?
There's a lot of new young ones. For some reason, Florence and the Machine have named me as an influence, as have Marina and the Diamonds, and quite a few other people recently have named me as an influence, and it's just brought in a very, very young audience for me.
That's terrific. How do you feel about the old material now?
It's fun. It's I can see why it's not mainstream, but it's really great to perform live. It gives you something to think about. None of it is predictable. I didn't learn to sing within a four-bar structure until only about 10 years ago. I used to sing across bars and just improvise. So to relearn this material and to perform it as it was is quite demanding in many ways. And the subject matter is quite bleak and gothic. So it's intriguing to perform it now.
And I saw you were digging out some of your old outfits. Do they still fit?
Yes, they still fit. I'm digging them out for a show in the centre of London at the Leicester Square Theatre.
Yes, I'm hoping to come out to that one.
Oh, well, we must meet.
Yeah, I'm very
come
excited.
Come with Craig Ashley, my webmaster.
Right.
He'll get you in. For that show, I'm going to have full hair, full makeup, and costume changes.
So you think
for that show.
So yeah, oh, wow. Yeah, that's definitely the one I need to see then.
It's the one to be at.
Are there any songs from that time or any of your albums that make you cringe when you hear them now?
Bird in Flight, which is probably one of the most popular songs with all of the fans.
Really?
Makes me completely embarrassed.
Now, that was one of the singles, right?
Yeah.
Was it one of the four from Toya ones? Or?
No, it was a single. I think it was a double A-side with Tribal Look.
Right, right.
About 1979. And it's possibly the worst lyric I've ever
written. So you won't be doing that one.
Oh, we do it. They go mad.
Really? You got to do, that's the hit and you got to do it.
Yeah.
What was the biggest hit you had in England? Was it Danced?
No, it was a song called It's a Mystery.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which, I mean, went gold many times over. So that was probably a biggie.
Just listening to your records and not, you know, knowing what charted and what didn't, I always felt that I Want to Be Free would have been a fabulous hit, was it?
It was massive.
Yeah. I do that. That's the one song of yours I see in karaoke books. And
SingStar have just licensed it off me, so it's going into all the karaoke.
And I do that on a regular basis, and people are like, I don't know that song. That's really cool.
Oh, brilliant. Well, that song was a huge hit virtually everywhere but America.
Yeah. Does it frustrate you to have not really broken here?
Yes and no, because I've never gone out and spent time and worked the market.
Right.
I've always been a bit of a home bird,
mm-hmm.
being mainly based in England, so
right.
It's my own fault. But I would love to be in America acting, because I love your drama and I love your films a lot more than I do English stuff.
Really?
But that's because your drama is, it's so broad in its spectrum. I really think it's fabulous. But I still have enough energy and enough pep in me to bring the humans out there and make a go of it.
That's going to be so exciting. And you may hook up with some film people while you're here, certainly in L.A.
I'm going to try.
I also know you played, I'm not quite sure how long ago it was. I never noticed the dates of the articles I read. You played the Cavern Club.
Yes, that was 2 months ago.
Ah, that must have been so exciting. And there's a brick with your name on it.
I was so honored, because a lot of the time I'm just ridiculed the whole time in this country.
Oh.
I'm partly ridiculed because I'm a household name, which is always a problem with people here. But I arrived at the Cavern and they said, would you come outside with us? These were the organizers.
Mm-hmm.
They took me to the Beatles Museum, where there's a Wall of Fame. And they said, we want to present you with a brick in the wall. And
how
my
Pink
brick
Floyd.
Is next to Hendrix, Robert Plant, and
wow.
Robert Fripp.
Wow.
And I was just so bowled over. It's the first time I've been shown any respect as a musician in about 30 years.
Oh.
I mean, it really moved me. And then the concert itself was just mind-blowing.
Oh.
It was a great day.
What a place with so much history.
Oh, just brilliant, brilliant.
You say they give you a hard time over there. Do you think that the English are resentful of success?
Success does tend to be a problem for people in the long term here. They're just snobby. For instance, when the Humans played last year in London, and Robert was guesting with us, The review said that this was some of the most exciting stuff they ever heard. Robert's playing at his best, writing at his best.
Wow.
This is the Humans. Well, I wrote it.
So they just overlooked you entirely.
They just overlook you.
Oh, my goodness.
And they overlook you to deliberately insult you.
Do you think a lot of that, even in this day and age, is sexism as well?
Probably a little bit. I mean, I don't think anyone would put their hand up and say, oh, yes, I'm sexist, but
yeah.
It's just snobbery.
Yeah, well, I know it's really hard for female musicians. When I first got back to Kate Bush again, when I got the Kick Inside album, and I think she was 19 when that came out, and she, of course, wrote all the songs, and I had a friend of mine said, she didn't write the songs. You know, David Gilmour, one of those guys, wrote the songs. And I was like, how can you say that?
I know.
It's hard to believe.
I mean, Kate doesn't get any ridicule. She's loved.
Well, that's good. Well, I'm sorry that you don't get that kind of respect. I certainly have a lot of respect for you.
Well, I do get it from my fans, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, it is. I know you've developed quite a presence on Twitter these days. Are you a fan of the social media thing?
I don't. You're going to think I'm awful. I send the messages out.
Right.
I pre-post them, but I don't do any social networking at all because I wouldn't be able to write lyrics. I wouldn't be able to write my books. I have to learn a phenomenal amount of music. I've just finished a Beatles compilation album with Chris Neil, who is Celine Dion's producer.
Right.
I just finished that this week.
And you said you did two songs?
I did two songs solo and guested on another song.
With Kim Wilde, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm just doing the backing vocals at the end. It's a finale song on the album, and everyone on the album does the backing vocals at the end. But I could not work at the rate I work if I was socially networking. I just can't do it.
And you do the occasional blog as well?
I do the blog. I send out the messages, and I help run the site.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't communicate with people 24 hours a day. I'm running an office from about 6 in the morning till 8 at night. So, I've got to be where I'm needed.
But you feel like, I mean, it's a good source of visibility these days.
Oh, Twitter is vital. Twitter is, if you want to walk up on the night, you need a few hundred people walking up to a venue, you've got to be on Twitter and Facebook. That's where music is happening now.
Right. Are you at liberty to say which Beatles songs you recorded?
No, I'm not allowed to say.
Do you know when that's going to be coming out?
I hope very soon. It's a fantastic album. It's mainly well-known singers in Europe, but I think it will cross the Atlantic.
Well, just the fact that it's Beatles related, that gives you an instant market anyway.
Absolutely.
And Kim Wilde is another fabulous English singer who's never really... She had one hit here when she did You Keep Me Hanging On.
Well, she's had one hit more than me then.
Well, maybe your time is coming. When does the Humans album come out?
September.
Oh my goodness, that's so far away.
It's not that far away in terms of getting a release ready, though.
Right. You're getting ready to go to Seattle and work on that, right?
I'm in Seattle in 2 weeks,
right.
Filming a documentary for the Discovery Channel, but that gives me a chance to get things done with Bill. But it's all mastered and finished and just ready to go anyway.
Right. Thank you so much for spending a little time with us. I will definitely get in touch with your people when I come to London because I'm so excited about seeing you and getting a chance to talk face-to-face.
Be in touch with Craig Astley because we'll give you a preview album of The Humans.
Well, he did send me one of your songs, so I'll be able to play it tonight.
Thank you.
And thank you so much. Happy anniversary to you and Robert. Happy birthday to both of you. Thank you so much, Toya.
That's a pleasure, Julie. We'll talk again and we will meet in June.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okie doke.
Bye-bye.
Bye.